We've got to stop this wild desire in you and in me. So we'll let the flame burn once again until the thrill is gone. Then we'll sweep out the ashes in the morning. We're two people caught up in a flame that has to die down soon. I didn't mean to start this fire, and neither did you. So tonight, when you hold me tight, we'll let the fire burn on. Then we'll sweep out the ashes in the in the morning.
Graham Parsons and Emmylou Harris will sweep out the ashes in the morning. Think originally from GP here, collected on a Rhino anthology. Bad Indians before that are on the other side, named the new CD, from which we heard Trisha said. Before that it was Warm Climate. LP is called Glass Singer. We heard Calculate the Greatness. Net Shaker prior to that, I'm So Cold, the name of the LP, from which we heard Be Back. I.O., a duo flamenco guitar improvisation group. Flamenco Abstractions is what it's called. We heard an untitled track, number 4. Yupala Kayapio from Rehuha Groves did Mycophiles and Pebbles. Kesar by Kirkar from a self-titled collection of ragas. I believe this is a night raga. Nat Kamad Nevar Baju Ray. We opened that set with a little bit of music from the Polish psych prog band SBB. And boy, we might as well end the show on a complete pronunciation failure. Ze Slowem Biegne Do Ciebie. From a record of the same name. Thanks for listening, everybody. My name's Scott. Always a joy to be with you on a Monday afternoon. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is next. You're listening to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockin' County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. See you next week. Ha ha ha.
last week, a hacker who goes by the name of Jucifer, or maybe it's Goosifer, cracked an email account of President George H.W. Bush and struck gold. He found two emails from George W. Bush to his sister with some images attached. Now, Goosifer presumably released these photos because he wanted to mock the president. Maybe he thought W. could be just as famous as that woman Cecilia Jimenez who ruined that fresco in Spain. But over the past few days, numerous Bush haters have come out of retirement to sing the praises of W., amateur painter, including Oliver Berkman, a writer and columnist at The Guardian, who joins us now. Oliver, can you describe these paintings for us? I really want to hear from you what captivates you about them.
Yeah, well, they are the two. There are three paintings that we can see in these photographs, two of them close up. And the two that we can see close up are one, apparently, of Bush in the shower with a reflection of a face in a shaving mirror that looks like it's Bush's face, although the perspective is kind of wrong. And then the other one is a picture of his legs in the bathtub with the water running into the tub. There's a third one that we can just about see, which is a painting of a church.
Yeah, it's the action photo of Bush of W in action.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it seems kind of interesting though too that both of the paintings that we see differ from the one where we see him painting, and that they really are these sort of isolated, single view, you know, the one with the legs in the bathtub where he's just staring at the wall. So strange that he's emailing them to his sister, as you point out. A bit odd.
Yeah, that is a little bit strange, isn't it? I mean, we should be clear. These aren't sort of explicit nudes. These are bits of his legs and bits of his arms, his back. It's all a bit strange. I think we've pretty much established that he's pretty strange person, but I don't think anyone becomes president without being pretty strange.
So why is everyone going nuts over these paintings? I mean, I think I've read about 20 articles, yours, of course, being the best one, but what the hell is going on, Oliver?
It's a fascinating thing, the effect of these paintings on people. I wouldn't describe myself necessarily as a Bush hater. I would describe myself as, like many people, mystified by him through the entirety of the administration and since then. The question has always been, you know, what is going on in there? Is this people have made the claim that he was, that his presidency was governed by the fact that he was not very intelligent. Others that it was more malevolent than that, or that he was working out all sorts of Oedipal things with regard to his father. And no one has ever really got to it. And there is something about the fact that self-portrait like this puts you inside somebody's head, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, but they're not even good.
Well, I mean, I suspect that critics would call them naive or childlike or something. I mean, I don't think they're terrible as pictures. They are, they are very simplified and simple. But that has a place in art that's taken more seriously. I think it's just that, yeah, you can't look at them without, on some level, looking through Bush's eyes, and that is a really strange experience for any one of us, I think, who sort of wondered all these years what it's like to be looking out through those eyes. I think that this just speaks to a much broader thing about, regardless of whether you admire or disdain a politician, when people are at that level of power and celebrity, we don't really relate to them, I think, on a day-to-day basis as if they are individual humans. Even the ones that we love, they are sort of symbols and placeholders and images rather than individuals. And there's something so uniquely individually subjective, not only about painting a self-portrait, but sort of clearly struggling with the perspective and struggling to paint a self-portrait. I hasten to add, I don't think I'd do any better. But in a way, that's the kind of strange, almost empathy triggering thing. Of course, when I wrote this, I was immediately assailed for being an apologist for the Iraq War or for any other Bush policy. I'm not suggesting that it sort of has any effect on history's judgment of the Bush administration, but it just does do that very strange, disorienting thing of reminding you that, you know, it's humans who make these policies and carry them out.
Yeah, but I've always been amazed at how the Reagan cult grew and grew after his presidency. It was like America wanted, like, consciously wanted to forget all about the Iran-Contra scandals, the Star Wars crap. It's like they just wanted this nice old doddering Uncle Ronnie. And I guess that's what scares me here with this opening of empathy and in W's direction. I mean, how far are we going to take it?
There was a wonderful Onion headline about based around the idea that he'd just returned from 4 years in the Himalayas with a long beard and much wisdom in his mind. I really love the idea of George Bush reinventing himself as an outsider artist, but I just think it's I don't think that's going to be happening.
One of the greatest George W. Bush bashers I know is the writer and cartoonist and empathizer Tim Kreider. And so I asked him his thoughts on George W. Bush, outsider artist.
George W. Bush was an especially opaque president. I mean, he seemed to have no interior life. His critics called him willfully incurious, unreflective. I spent the Bush years as a political cartoonist, and in order to make George Bush funny, I created a character for him. He was hapless, childlike, always in way over his head. I despised the real-life George Bush, but I couldn't help but love and pity the cartoon one. So there was something very strange, both troubling and weirdly touching for me, about seeing the alleged artwork of my former nemesis posted on the internet. I'm assuming, by the way, that these paintings are not a hoax, because if I were a creative and intelligent hoaxer, these are pretty much exactly the paintings I would have crafted to give people a sort of tantalizing look at George Bush's inner life, something very unexpected. Because George's paintings are not like those of most famous politicians turned painter. Hitler, Churchill, Eisenhower, they all painted landscapes, which is, you know, an appropriately conventional, dignified subject. There's one photo where we see George Bush working on a landscape. It's of a church, I think. And technically, his best painting is actually of his dog, Buddy. It's kind of a paint-by-numbers thing, but he did paint it himself, and honestly, it's a pretty good likeness of the dog. But far and away, the most interesting paintings of his are self-portraits in the bath. One critic compared them to Bonnard's paintings of his wife, Marat. And I thought of Bonnard right away, too. On one level, this is a pretty obvious, superficial comparison. I mean, yeah, it's someone in a bathtub. But there's also a similar feel of witnessing some intimate, private moment. There is a stillness, a quietude in these paintings that are not how you imagine the inner life of G.W. Bush. There's something really disquieting and poignant, really, about seeing George naked and alone. And there's something especially powerful about seeing it from his own subjective point of view. It reminds me of those lines from Lear when the exiled king rips his own clothes off in the rain. Thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more but such a poor, bare, forked animal as thou art. I don't know, maybe these are arbitrarily chosen subjects, but even if he was just the most convenient model to paint, there's something refreshingly unselfconscious about the choice. You can't help but project into these paintings a desire for self-knowledge. Painting or drawing something is a kind of meditation. In order to represent something well, you have to really see that thing, to come to know it. In a way, you can't help but love it. Simply having spent as much time as he must have on these paintings, put in the necessary hours of studying himself, speaks of a kind of inarticulate desire to see himself truly, to know himself. He even paints himself looking at himself in the shaving mirror, which to me echoes Norman Rockwell's triple self-portrait, which was a humorous expose of his own deluded self-image. It's an image from this most infamously unreflective president of self-reflection. Thank you.
You're listening to WFMU. Yours truly, Benjamin Walker. This is the Too Much Information podcast program. And we just heard from Tim Kreider and Oliver Berkman talking about George W. Bush, outsider artist. If you haven't seen those yet, and I don't see how that's possible. I guess the Pope did throw W off the front pages this morning, but over the weekend, it really was amazing to see how many folks were pontificating about W's artistic abilities. So I couldn't resist that one. We're taking a break from the regular type of programming on TMI, and we're featuring other programs, other spoken word pieces from the library, from the internets, from other radio makers. And it's a good thing. Last week, station manager Ken said I just sounded so sad and pathetic as I did my break. So I believe I upped the medication dosage, and everything is better now. But we're going to try to play something from a series called Unfictional that runs out of KCRW in L.A. And this is a program about the mobster Whitey Bulger, who evaded the FBI for a long time. And I've wanted to hear this for a while, and it's pretty great. So I'm going to share it with you here on WFMU. We'll let the Losel track play out, and then we'll push the magic button. All right, hopefully this isn't going to jump cut. But I was just trying to avoid that. You're listening to a podcast lingo here. So let's see.
I'm sure we've all lived in an apartment from time to time. And as you know, you can hear some really personal living through those walls, even if we later just nod and say hello when we see the neighbors on the elevator. At one time, my wife and I lived in a big complex of apartment towers, and you'd see the same faces all the time, but only rarely speak to them. But we definitely made up stories about our fellow tenants, like the elderly gay man who wore a scarf was the theatrical producer. The tall guy with the fashionable glasses was the architect. There was the actor dude, the swim class lady, and the improv parents. Now, it just so happens that on one occasion, when I was feeling uncharacteristically chatty, I asked the tall guy with the fashionable glasses what he did for a living, and he was an architect. I guess sometimes you can just read people, and sometimes you can't.
I never ever saw him without his round beige hat.
When he was outside, you didn't see him without a hat on.
Kind of a beach hat, pulled down in the front, and very old-fashioned glasses he had.
In this story, it's the most unassuming and ordinary people in the building that have a secret that ends up more far-fetched than anything their neighbors would ever dream up, and it made their fellow tenants try and figure out who they'd been living next to for the last 15 years. On this episode of Unfictional, who is the couple in 303?
Pretty much any place you go, you can find a couple like the Gascos, Charlie and Carol. Nice couple, unremarkable, unmemorable, but perfectly nice, from what I hear. The kind of people you might want for a neighbor. And they were my neighbors. For 15 years, until one night last summer. I lived right across the street from the Gascos, on 3rd Street in Santa Monica. A quiet block. Some buildings have fancy names like the Embassy and the Princess Eugenia. They mostly look pretty average, though. Pretty boring, in fact. Not exactly boring, more like unexceptional. Perfectly nice. Kind of like the Gascos.
I mean, they were really, really nice people.
Brigida Farinelli manages my apartment building and the one across the street. Katrina Hardy lived downstairs from the Gascos.
In fact, I often used to think to myself, they were the most regular, normal, nice, decent couple I know in LA.
Low key, low maintenance. They hardly never called and complained to the building. They had a problem in the apartment.
Well, one night last summer, that's when everything changed.
I had this craving for yogurt, frozen yogurt.
My neighbor John Weisskopf first noticed something when he ran out for a snack.
So I drove up to Menchie's because I figured Menchie's was closed at, up in Montana, was closed at 10 o'clock. So I said, well, I've got to go. But when I came out of the building, I noticed that there were two SUVs parked in the red zone in front of the embassy. The cars were locked. There were no lights on. There were no flashers on. They were just there, and there was nobody around. And I said, they're going to get a ticket. So I went up to Menchie's, took my time, left there. As I pulled up the street, there were police cars, and I saw some lights, and I was like, what the hell is going on?
Barbara Gluck lives across the street from me in the Princess Eugenia apartments.
I came back from a meeting at about a little after 7 on that Wednesday evening. I pulled into the driveway, and there were two gentlemen in gray suits with big silver gold FBI badges that said to me, do you live in this building? You know, give me a break, you know? And I said, yes, I do. And they said, okay, you can enter. And I said, who are you and what are you doing here? And they said, we're with the FBI. We just arrested someone in your building.
But as I started to walk up the street, I saw a flash from a camera in front of the Princess Eugenia. And then as I got closer, I saw this police photographer, and she had the camera, but she had gloves on. And I thought, somebody must have gotten killed.
I go upstairs to come to the 3rd floor, elevator door opens, and right in front of the elevator door are dozens of FBI and police. And then to the left, which is where apartment 303 is, there are all sorts of people inside.
Apartment 303, the Gascos?
So my boss called me and she said, Brigida, she said, you haven't heard the news about the Gascos?
And I came in, I watched the 11 o'clock news, and I saw his face, and I saw her face, and I was like, oh my God.
People were used to seeing the Gascos taking walks together. A walk in the morning and a walk in the evening. But now they wouldn't be taking those walks anymore. Because Charlie and Carol Gasco, those really nice people, turns out they didn't actually exist.
From the global resources of ABC News, this is Nightline.
Good evening, I'm Terry Moran. We begin with breaking news tonight, the capture of a major U.S. fugitive, the legendary Boston Irish mobster, James Whitey Bulger. Bulger, wanted in connection with 19 murders, racketeering, and other crimes, was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Bulger was captured tonight in, of all places, Santa Monica.
He pretended to be Charles Gasco.
I saw him
in handcuffs
outside of one of the FBI's car in the garage.
My other building manager, Josh Bond, was the Gasco's next-door neighbor.
He seemed pretty calm. I even saw him laugh a couple times. They were just chatting with him and She was out there. Well, she was looking right at me, and she just said, "Hey, Josh, hey." I just kind of gave her a little nod. Really all I could muster at that point.
That night, the FBI tore up apartment 303. They found more than 30 weapons. Pistols, rifles, knives, hidden behind books, or stashed in holes Charlie cut in the walls and covered with mirrors. There were stacks of bills in there, too. Altogether, more than 800 grand.
When I got back at around 11:15, 11:30, it was a madhouse out there. There were just cops. I mean, the street was blocked off. There were cops everywhere, and there was just media all over the place.
The FBI has captured a mobster.
I came in and looked at the 11 o'clock news, and it was the lead story on every station.
On the lam, wanted for more than a decade.
Boston.
Holy smokes.
Well, I would just see them walk up and down the promenade. They said they took a walk every day at sunset.
I don't think I realized how big this was at first. I don't think I had any idea.
James Whitey Bulger.
Arrested along with his girlfriend in Santa Monica.
John didn't know Charlie Gasco at all.
From handguns to machine guns.
$800,000.
But that didn't stop him from jumping right into the middle of the media frenzy.
I didn't even know his name. Because there was never a conversation with him. I looked out the blinds, and all the lights were on outside. All the media trucks were out front. It was like nobody was sleeping. It was like, you know, Vegas at night. I had this need. Okay, I want to kind of share in this excitement in this thing and then be interviewed. And I went outside again. I said, well, why not? I'll go outside now and talk. I mean, within 5 seconds, three journalists converged on me like, you know, bees to honey. Like, boom! I did the interview. So I went into Google, and I typed in my name, a plus sign, and Whitey Bulger, and like 15 pages showed up. This was like in 3 or 4 hours, and they had spread this thing worldwide. It was in papers in India, it was in, you know, Europe, it was all over.
Catalina Schlenk lives on the first floor. She didn't know anything about this until she stepped out to get her paper the next morning.
It was an avalanche of journalists and photographers, and they were flashing the identification, but I didn't have my glasses on. I said, no, and I went inside.
For a week, my block was jammed with news vans and satellite trucks. Even the bus that takes tourists to movie stars' homes started coming down 3rd Street. Whole families drove up to take pictures. I took pictures, too.
This is where Whitey and Greg have been hiding out for years.
The arrest of Bulger and Grieg ended their sham retirement in this seaside community.
Barbara Gluck told reporters that Charlie Gasco had snapped at her once in the hall. She called him a rageaholic. And that's the word you saw printed in all the papers that week. They weren't so accurate reporting what Josh said.
Yeah, a half a bottle of Grand Marnier that he gave me turned into, he gave me expensive bottles of whiskey. He told me he served in Korea, turned into, I could tell by the look in his eyes, he'd killed a man. So,
so you couldn't tell by the look in his eyes that he killed a man?
No.
Remember what my neighbor John said about not knowing Charlie Gasco? Well, I didn't know Charlie either. I do remember talking to Carol. She used to feed a stray cat out in front of our building. But Charlie, Whitey, I must have passed him on the street lots of times. Is it possible he was just that forgettable?
Cold ice, little eyes. And they were just daggers.
He had such a stare of blankness. He was so scary.
Oh, he stabbed people, he beat people with bats, he shot people, strangled people, run them over cars.
Like I said, nothing. But my neighbors, different story.
He was handsome. He had blue eyes, very nice smile, and kind. It looked like kind face.
He controls the Irish Winter Hill Gang through fear, torture, and murder.
This guy used to look out at Boston and say, I own this town.
I imagined him to have been a middle class business person.
I just thought, you know, that he and maybe had a very good job once in his life.
He is a predator in every sense of the word.
I always assumed that he was not a high-powered agent, but a producer maybe that was putting something together and whatever.
But how well do any of us know our neighbors? I mean, beyond a name, a few facts. Like John, the one who went for frozen yogurt. I know he's married, he's into bicycling, and he writes novels. Brigida, the building manager, she's from Sweden and she speaks 7 languages. The other manager, Josh, he plays guitar and sings with a country band.
I don't know about singing.
Okay.
But I'm gonna play.
Yeah, okay.
Josh says he was practicing one day and there was a knock on the door.
He said, you know, I'm Charlie, I'm your neighbor. He said he liked the music I was playing and it was kind of country style music. He had this big black case and opening it up, gave me a cowboy hat. I mean, it kind of fits, but my head's pretty big.
Over the next few years, Charlie stopped by pretty often.
So would he sit down and hang out?
No, we just usually just stand at the door. I mean, mainly just talked about music. You know, he liked to talk about anything, really. Probably wasn't paying attention all the time.
This harmless-looking little old man is extremely dangerous.
See, if your neighbor looks harmless and acts harmless, why would you ever go looking him up on the FBI's Most Wanted?
I'm satisfied to just have the surface, superficial relationships of saying, oh, hi, how are you?
Plus, you figure the manager must have checked him out before he moved in. Janice Goodwin lived down the hall from the Gascos.
Only Mrs. Haskell would have done no background check.
Marjorie Haskell was the building manager when the Gascos first came to Santa Monica.
I sort of had the impression that Marjorie rented to people she liked.
Yes, it seemed quite personal, really, and yes.
She thought you were a good person.
Yes.
So I guess she liked them.
Yeah, she must have done.
As it turns out, Mrs. Haskell had pretty good judgment. The Gascos always paid on time. They rarely complained. They were excellent tenants. That's all any of us want from each other. It's kind of like a pact we make. We don't ask a lot of questions about where our neighbors come from or how they make a living.
You know, it's not a community. It's a building. They're acquaintances.
All we know, all we care about, really, is who they are in the present. Like, I remember Carol, Catherine, as the nice lady I'd see feeding a stray cat out in front of my building.
And were any of these walls common walls with you?
This one is.
Any guns in that one?
I don't think so.
And Josh remembers Charlie, Whitey, for his acts of generosity over the years.
Yeah, he gave me that curling bar right there in the free weights. He gave me another old stomach crunch machine one time. He gave me those candles over there, those white candles. Christmas stationery, like, you know, to write thank you notes on and stuff. Beard trimmer, some long sleeve white t-shirts. He gave me a thermos. He gave me some shoelaces one time.
Did you need shoelaces?
No.
Sometimes it's only after neighbors move away that we hit on the little things, the oddities, the clues about what their lives were really like. With the Gascos, it's all little things you wouldn't find suspicious. But put them all together, with the benefit of hindsight, it lays out almost like a rule book for gangsters on the run. Rule 1, wear a disguise.
I never ever saw him without his round beige hat.
When he was outside, you didn't see him without a hat on.
Kind of a beach hat, pulled down in the front, and very old-fashioned glasses he had.
2, keep a low profile.
That's all they really did, was sort of spend a lot of time in the apartment.
I said to her how dark it is in here, and that's when she told me that Charlie doesn't like to have a lot of light.
Rule 3, keep your mouth shut.
She'll meet someone, like another lady in the hallway, and they start a conversation or something. And Charlie would come out in the hallway and say, Carol, come back inside, please. I want to talk to you, or something like that.
4, stay off the phone.
She said, oh, I don't think Charlie wants to have a phone, because, you know, nobody calls us, she said, and we never call anybody.
5, don't get too chummy with the neighbors.
The odd thing is I would never be given a chair to sit in, so I would always stand, and so would she. And I was never offered a drink or anything to eat or anything like that.
Unless it's a neighbor who can't talk.
Anybody who had an animal basically knew them by name because they liked animals.
I said, Carol, what are you doing? She said, oh, I'm feeding Tiger. Nobody's giving him any food. I feel so sorry for him. I love cats.
Rule 6, always pay in cash.
She used to pay the rent always a week before the rent was due. New bills, not wrinkly old bills. Always hundreds, you know. So I used to kid around with her, and I used to say, well, Carol, did you rob the bank again?
Which leads to our final rule. Always have a cover story.
And she was kind of laughing, and she said, well, I had to go down to the bank, you know, so I thought I might as well take out the money for the rent.
Now, if we'd really been paying attention, there were a few things that were harder to explain. Like it turns out Barbara, the one who used the term rageaholic, Barbara's not the only neighbor who saw Charlie lose his temper. She's just the only one who talked to me about it on tape.
And he was grumpy. She and I would stop to talk, he would go, stop talking, let's go. You know, he was impatient. I mean, he was not very nice. And she was lovely and very kind.
But there was that note on the Gasco's door.
It said, do not knock at any time ever.
Carol told the neighbors Charlie was developing Alzheimer's. Janice even tried to help out when she saw Charlie getting arrested.
I went over and I said, this gentleman has Alzheimer's, and I thought that might help you with whatever it is that you're doing. And they said, ma'am, when you see this many FBI standing around, there's something serious going on.
In the end, the FBI trucked away everything in apartment 303. The furniture, Whitey and Catherine's clothes, the boxing dummy he kept by the front window, the tubes of crazy glue from the 99-cent store.
The Embassy Hotel Apartments, this is Josh, can you hold?
The office got lots of calls about the apartment. Crime buffs wanted to rent it with the holes still in the walls. The building owners told them that wasn't an option. They sent the super, Enrique Sanchez, and his crew to patch the holes and paint the place. Enrique and Charlie were friends. He didn't want to talk on tape. But he told me, even if he'd known Charlie's history, he wouldn't have turned him in. Not even for the $2 million reward. Enrique says Whitey Bulger, the crime boss they talk about on the news, that wasn't the person he knew. The rest of us still aren't so sure who actually lived in apartment 303 those 15 years. Was it the monster Whitey Bulger, disguised as a nice old man in a beige hat? Or did he really change?
Plumbia County Correctional Facility is Whitey Bulger's new home, at least for the time being. He arrived just before 7 o'clock.
And if he did change, what happened to nice Charlie Gasco after he got arrested? Who is that up at Plymouth Correctional? Is that Whitey Bulger they've got locked up in solitary? Or is it Charlie?
For me, it's like we are talking about two personalities completely different. Maybe the moment that he came to Santa Monica, said, okay, that's it, I am changing now, I start a new life. I don't know, but I cannot even think that he could kill a fly.
And yet he had 30 guns in his apartment.
That's what they say.
Just the fact that I was their friend makes me ill. And it's very scary to me. Yeah. Very scary.
The way Janice sees it, she lived down the hall from a psychopath for 15 years. Months later, she still doesn't feel secure.
I have a healthy fear of being eliminated.
You're afraid now?
Absolutely.
I thought I knew her really well, and him, and your next-door neighbor, you have no idea. I miss them, though, I really do, because both of them were very nice.
I miss their presence. I mean, the presence that we assume, you know, that they seem to be having, because they were just so part of the whole building and area, really.
All I can say is they were very good to me and very kind to me while I lived there, and you know, reconciling that with the fact that he murdered innocent people, I'm not really sure how to understand that. Or if I really need to.
It seems the Gascos haven't forgotten about us either. Here's Brigida.
I was sorting the mail downstairs, and I see this letter, and I see from Whitey Bulger, Plymouth Correctional Center, and I thought, mamma mia, you know, I was really surprised.
Whitey had actually started writing to a few people in the building. Brigida says she saw one of the letters.
So he said he's very lonely, but he does get correspondence from Catherine. And in one of the correspondence, Catherine said, "I do not regret the 16 last years of my life with you." And he had answered that he don't regret anything because they loved each other. They were very much in love, apparently.
How did he sign the letter?
Whitey Bulger, a.k.a. Charlie Gaskell.
Charlie wrote in his letter, he was sorry he had to leave without saying goodbye.
Think you'll ever have an experience like this again?
No. I doubt it. I don't think I'll ever live next to an old mafia boss again that's arrested.
And you never know.
It's true. I'll definitely be more aware of who I'm living next to now.
We want to trust each other. Like Marjorie Haskell trusted the Gaskos when she rented them an apartment. Like we all implicitly trust each other not to turn out to be murderers. Because how else are you supposed to live?
Can't really think about it any other way.
Yeah.
Keep living as if I never had a fugitive living next to me, you know.
How do you feel that you had the most wanted man in America living in your building?
Well, I'm relieved that he didn't strangle me. Maybe he wouldn't because he sympathized with me.
Tiwi seemed like a nice guy.
The same thing that I'm talking to you. So I don't know you.
Right, I could be terrible. You don't know.
You don't know.
You don't know.
You never know who is next to you.
The Couple in 303 was produced by Gideon Brower and Eric Drachman. It was edited by Jacob Conrad and mixed by Bob Carlson. Special thanks to Andrew Terman and Christine McKenna. Here's a quick epilogue. A year after the arrests, Whitey Bulger, 82 years old, waits in solitary for his trial on racketeering and murder charges, 19 murder charges in all. Catherine Grieg pleaded guilty to harboring a fugitive and identity fraud. She's been sentenced to 8 years in prison. The FBI unsealed a ton of documents related to Catherine's prosecution, including a thorough inventory of Apartment 303. The guns, the cash, Whitey's AARP card, lots of ID, driver's licenses, birth certificates. The FBI photographed the bookshelves, too. Turns out Whitey owned quite a few books about the Irish mob. And the FBI found soap, lots of soap, and hand sanitizer, mouthwash, paper towels. There's a thank you note from Josh, Valentine's cards, an American flag poster and a ceramic crucifix, some pictures of cats, and a cat calendar, and a coffee table book about cats, and some porcelain cats, too. There's a throw pillow, maybe from one of the yard sales Catherine went to. There's a saying embroidered on it. It reads, "Give a man an inch, and he thinks he's a ruler." The FBI also unsealed the witness interviews. They include some of the same stories people told me, and some new ones. Catherine's hairdresser in Santa Monica remembers Catherine saying how she always loved the bad boys. She said her husband had been a really bad boy when she married him, but that he was more mellow now.
Well, that was The Couple in 303 from a program called Unfictional. I myself thought that was going to be more of a delicatessen-style apartment building tale with Whitey Bulger, but it could have gone a lot differently, neighbors. Let's keep the suburban living theme going here, and now we're going to hear something from a podcast called 99% Invisible, with a tale about the cul-de-sac here on WFMU.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. When people critique cul-de-sacs, a lot of the time they're actually critiquing the suburbs more generally. The cul-de-sac has become sort of like the mascot of the suburbs. Like if suburbia had a flag, it would have a picture of a cul-de-sac on it.
I can still remember how strange that word sounded to me when my mom told me we were moving from the city of Atlanta to the suburbs of Denver, and that we'd be living on one of these things.
Hey, that's producer Katie Mingle doing my work this week.
Hi, Roman.
The cul-de-sac is a French term, literally meaning the bottom of the bag, or the ass of the bag.
So it's no wonder the French themselves prefer to use the word impasse.
Another fun fact, the plural of cul-de-sac is actually culs-de-sac, but Katie and I have agreed that it isn't possible to refer to them this way without sounding like a couple of ass bags.
I've always felt a little embarrassed by my suburban roots, by the cul-de-sac especially, which, with its uterine shape and having the word sac in it, gave me the feeling that I spent my early years coddled and sheltered in an asphalt womb.
Living on a cul-de-sac has come to symbolize everything that young hipsters or just people who don't see suburbia as the American dream have come to despise, and it's taken on this symbolic role.
That's Matt Lassiter, and I think he just called you a hipster.
Yep, I think he did.
It's come to epitomize suburbia both in the myth of the kind of happy nuclear family American dream and in the way that critics condemn it as a facade.
Matt teaches a history of the suburbs course at the University of Michigan.
And the great age of the cul-de-sac is the 1950s and 1960s.
Matt says that by the 70s and 80s, our faith in the nuclear family and in the suburban American dream was starting to break down, and it's evident all over pop culture, like in the 1980s classic, E.T.
At the beginning of the film, we learn that Elliot's parents are divorced and his father is down in Mexico with his girlfriend. His mom's there alone, and the family's sitting around the table, and they're very sad.
Nothing like that breath!
Elliot! Sit down.
Dad would believe me.
Maybe you ought to call your father and tell him about it.
I can't. He's in Mexico with Sally.
And then E.T. comes from outer space, you know, almost like a savior figure, to bring happiness back to this sad, broken suburban family. And I think it's really striking in the film the way that Elliot can find freedom and excitement in the suburbs by riding his bicycle, you know, to the end of the cul-de-sac and then beyond into the woods in the kind of magical fringe where the subdivision stops and the wilderness begins.
E.T. is devastating to me. And I get Lassiter's point about E.T. providing the escape hatch to the horrible, oppressive cul-de-sac, but I also think you can't deny the fact that the kids in E.T. ruled the neighborhood. I mean, the boys outmaneuvered the feds on their dirt bikes.
It's a great place to be if you're 7 years old and you want to ride your big wheel out in the street, but it's not a great place to live, I would argue, if you're 14 years old and want to get out of the neighborhood and you don't have a car, then you start feeling trapped.
Cul-de-sacs do tend to be isolating. They aren't connected to other streets and they're far away from town centers. But even though cul-de-sacs are experiencing a backlash right now, they were themselves part of a design backlash against urban living and the traditional grid pattern streets that make up most cities.
We think about the cul-de-sac-based subdivision and its opposite, which is the urban grid pattern. But if you go back before World War II, there was a third alternative, which was the early garden suburbs that had curvilinear streets, but they were designed to fit in with the landscape, to create buffers between the houses, to integrate people into parks and lakes and other natural features. And so it was the opposite of the grid pattern, but it wasn't the cul-de-sac based kind of end of the road dead end pattern. The streets almost always came back around to other streets.
It was when the suburbs became mass produced after World War II that the worst aspects of suburban design began to dominate.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same.
Whether or not you buy the idea that cul-de-sacs are psychologically oppressive or stifling to the freedom of those that live there, they have some real quantifiable design flaws.
Right, like imagine being a garbage collector or a street cleaner. And instead of driving down one long street and collecting all the garbage from that street and then taking a right onto the next street and so on, you have to turn around in all of these cul-de-sacs over and over again. It takes more time, you use more gas. They're expensive to maintain. And now some governments, like the one in the state of Virginia, are starting to ban them in all new developments.
For many homeowners, when it comes to moving into a new subdivision, they try to find a cul-de-sac because they say it is the best spot to be in. But now, leaders in the Commonwealth are telling developers if they build a new subdivision, they can leave these cul-de-sacs out. Kim Nelson and her two kids moved into this new subdivision 8 months ago. She specifically picked this street because it was a cul-de-sac.
We like living in a cul-de-sac area because it gives us an opportunity for our children to play in a very safe environment.
Like many other owners, Nelson says they don't have to worry about speeding cars or streets with a lot of traffic.
Wait, who are we calling?
My mom.
Hey, Mom.
Hey, honey.
You know, I've been doing all this research about cul-de-sacs, and I guess I'm wondering how you could move our family to such a depraved place.
We loved the cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a place where, you know, you were allowed to go out there all hours of the day and night and play and be pretty much unsupervised.
Oh, she sounds nice.
She's the nicest, and it's true, I did love the cul-de-sac. I didn't like school, and I didn't fit in there, but none of that seemed to matter on the cul-de-sac. On the cul-de-sac, it was all about ghost in the graveyard and finding the guts to launch off the skateboard ramp, and that was a world I shined in. My parents, though, they always seemed like they lived there just for me, and after I moved away, eventually they did too. Now my mom and dad live in a new development that urban planners would refer to as mixed use. That's shops and houses and restaurants all mixed in together. They love it. They live right above the Gap. There's a library within walking distance. My dad helps lead a lecture series in their condo. And I like that as they get older, they won't need to be dependent on a car to get what they need. It's perfect for them. But for a kid?
Where do the kids play?
Where do they play?
Yeah.
The one family that I'm thinking of who live up on the fifth floor, their children are pretty young, and they have talked about they go to different parks around the area quite often.
Going to parks with mom and dad doesn't sound nearly as cool as taking over an entire street every night.
It's really a type of suburban development that's organized around the needs of 5-year-olds or 8-year-olds or 10-year-olds.
Professor Laster argues that we shouldn't be designing our neighborhoods exclusively around the needs of 5-year-olds.
And new studies are showing that as gas prices rise and people become more ecologically conscious, we're already seeing a reverse flight back out of the suburbs and into cities. There are even fears that suburbs will turn into ghost town slums and ghettos of the future.
That would really give Ghost in the Graveyard a whole new edge.
Indeed.
"99% Invisible" was produced this week by Katie Mingle from the great Third Coast International Audio Festival. Go look it up. And me, Roman Mars, with support from Lunar, making a difference with creativity. It's a project of KALW, 91.7 local public radio in San Francisco, the Center for Architecture and Design.
So that was from a podcast called 99% Invisible, Coles de Sacks, from Roman Mars. My name is Benjamin Walker. Hope you enjoyed all the spoken word and podcast we featured on the program today. All the information and links can be found at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Nardwar coming up. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show.
Listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, DJ Eddie J, Crazy Ed, returns yet again. DJ Crazy Ed, a Vancouver record collector's, returning for Just for Fun. Yes, Ed's gonna play some stuff just for fun. Crazy Ed, Ed Lasko, on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU.
A preachment, dear friends, you're about to receive on John Barleycorn, nicotine, and the temptations of Eve.
Okay, that's it. It was so good.
Oh, once I was happy and had a good wife. I had enough money to last me for life. I met with a gal and we went on a spree. She taught me to smoke and drink whiskey,
cigarettes and whiskey and wild, wild women.
Will you?
Please. Cigarettes is a blot on the whole human race. A man is a monkey with one in his face. Here's my definition, believe me, dear brother. A fire on one end, a fool on the t'other.
Cigarettes and whiskey and wild, wild women.
Somebody get that bum out of here. Brother, repent or they'll write on your grave. Two women in whiskey, here lies a poor slave. Take warning, dear stranger, take warning, dear friend. They'll write in big letters these words at the end.
Cigarettes and whiskey and wild, wild women.
Hold it, brethren. My friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. We don't sing that kind of music here.
Okay, then show us your muscles.
And you're listening to the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. And we have a special guest in the studio. Hello, are you there, guest?
Yowza, I'm here, boss.
Who are you?
Well, this is Crazy Ed.
Crazy Ed, what did we hear and what are we going to do today?
Well, we're going to play some, we're going to have an awful lot of fun. It's meeting a John Barleycorn and the Temptations of Eve, and we're playing, I guess, some pretty weird stuff in all kinds of different categories to kick off this segment of the show.
You're calling it kind of Ed's Weird and Cool Closet. Well, actually, I'm calling it. Actually, who are you, Ed, in case people are wondering, who are you?
As I said, it's Crazy Ed. What else do you want to know here?
Vancouver record collector Ed Lasko with his weird, cool, and crazy closet. And when we opened the closet there, what did we begin with? A kind of allusion to the band The Hombres? Please explain, Ed.
Well, The Hombres, with their big hit, Let It All Out, stole the intro right from that record. And actually, that was a huge hit record in June of 1947. Would you believe that that one was number one on the Pop Hit Parade? 15 weeks it was on the hit parade, and it also charted on the country and western hit parade. It was number two for 11 weeks. Can you believe that? And on the charts, country and western for 18 weeks.
What version did you hear first?
I heard that, you know what, way back in the 50s when I was listening to what my folks were listening to. Every Sunday we had a kind of a ritual. We would have pancakes, and while we were eating the pancakes or cooking them, we would listen to CKNW, excuse me. And they used to have a show that was called Just for Fun. And I used to hear it on Just for Fun. And that's what we're doing today, Nardwar. It's all Just for Fun.
Just for Fun. There's the title. Just for Fun with Ed Lasko. And Ed Lasko, what do we got coming up right now, Just for Fun?
Well, we're doing, like I say, we're going to do some all kinds of strange stuff and from all categories. And this is a strange sound. So this is a strange instrument to be used in rock and roll. This is a rock and roll song from June 55. A band called The Commanders. Actually, the Commanders, their great claim to fame, they did have a minor hit in 53, but in 55, they were the first band to cover Whole Lotta Shakin' Goin' On. But this particular cut that we're about to hear is called The Monster. And The Monster is a bass saxophone. And I saw a picture of a rock band, Nardwar, where this cat was playing a bass saxophone. I could not believe it. Can you believe a saxophone that this guy was playing? He was like 5'10", 6 feet, something. This saxophone went from his lip all the way to the floor. This saxophone was like 5.5 feet tall. It takes a lot of lung power to move a machine like that. That's why it's rare. And that's what we're about to hear in The Monster by The Commanders.
Just for Fun with DJ
Eddie J.